New York City in the early 70s, and then made my base in this part of the world about 10 years ago. Found that he was here.
I was speaking to someone the other day about when I ran to him in the Western Open some years ago.
Yeah.
I was with one of my students, and I told him, you know, I like sometimes going to places in which I've never been and knowing those. Walking through the building in the Western Open, and there you were.
So you've been doing some chanting?
Yeah.
How long?
I've been chanting since about 6 o'clock.
Oh.
People have been gradually arriving.
How many copies of Bhagavad Gita do you have here?
Just one, and I'll pack everything up.
Ah, already getting ready to go. Well, if you get one out. So tonight we're going to be discussing how to be a mystic within the city. That is a great art, a great technology. How in the midst of the urban environment you can develop your inner spiritual potential. Just that effort in of itself is a great mystical art, because as you know, the city is a place where there's endless distraction. You often don't realize the distraction until you go out into the country, and then you can feel that you've been under a barrage. Ears, your mind, your lungs. So how can it be that within the urban environment we can act as a mystic? Meaning someone who is trying to get in contact with a much deeper level of themselves. I take it all of you live in Brisbane? Living? No, you don't. You're out in a small town, 10,000, but you live in Brisbane, Doc?
Yes,
and
yes,
sir. Yeah. So, although Brisbane isn't the hugest city, have a seat. It's not the hugest city, but still, the urban environment is there. I'm sure some of you are thinking, is it possible to get to a deeper level of your life in your current environment? Or is your whole life going to be a battle with trying to preserve your calmness, your tranquility, trying to stay relatively free from constant distraction? How much are you on overload in terms of information, contacts, even relationships? A lot of people are suffering overload from relationships. You know, we hear it's like the type, but a lot of people change relationships just like they're changing clothes, fashions. Some people are on party or club overload. Others are on work overload. Others are on financial stress overload. And sometimes there's even physical overload. Disease overload. All these things are happening all the time. So an intelligent person is thinking, Is it possible to carve out some place of sanity for myself? But then you want to be more than just selfish, although that's a legitimate selfish desire. Hopefully, some of you are thinking, how can you benefit others in a real way? Not just a superficial way, but a real way. Produce lasting change. When I was in Manchester, UK, a couple of months ago, I met some young persons in their 20s, and they were committed social workers. Our whole life is just being with young people and hearing them and helping them and trying to get them to turn aside from destructive habits, just to be there for them. So I said, well, that's a very noble pursuit, but how much help do you really think you're giving? Do you really think you're touching the situation at its deepest level? Regardless of your sincere desires to help, how deep do you think you're really connecting in terms of problems and their root? And they just said, well, if we can just help someone to be a little bit better in their life, that's all we can expect. I said, you know the typical process, how they'll give up one addiction and just take up another addiction to replace it. You know that. Yes, but still, just to make that little impact, you feel is quite significant. So I explained to them that, yes, I also want to make an impact, but I want to cause something to happen at the deepest level. Otherwise, if we study history, we've seen for so many millennia there have been economic, political changes, social changes, but something is not touched. Some root or core of the problem is not touched. And therefore everything seems to go on more of the same. More of the same. So I try to impress upon them that if you really want to help, if you really want to care, if you really want to love, you have to be qualified. It was a theme we touched upon last night in our discussion. Most people don't think about it in that way. To love, you need to be qualified. To care for others, to help others, you need to be qualified. Now, people go to the university and they get degrees in this and that. But how many feel that they actually need to be qualified to love others? It just doesn't seem that way, the way the popular conception goes. If you want to love, you just reach out. Give someone a big hug. The temperature rises, that must be love. Or you try to care for their life, even though you don't know who you are and who they are, you just try to care. I'll be here for you. I don't know who I am, I don't know who you are, but I'll be here for you. Whenever you want to discuss something, you can lean on me, even though I don't know where I'm going. It reminds me of a famous statement by the existentialist philosopher Albert Camus. He said something which is probably considered quite normal these days, although maybe 50, 60 years ago it sounded a bit outrageous. He said, don't try to lead me. Don't try to follow me. Just walk together with me through the chaos. Of course, he ended his distinguished career by driving a sports car off a cliff on purpose. But that was the end result of his philosophy. So, I wonder how many of us understand that in order to care for others, we require qualification. If we want to truly love, we need to know what we're doing. When I was speaking in St. Petersburg, Russia, we were discussing this problem. the audience questions. I said, I know this is not the way you do things in Russia, but suppose you do like this. The next time someone tells you, I love you, ask that person, what's it going to do for me? Just think about it in your mind. Yeah. It's not naturally you wouldn't say anything like that, but it is a practical question. It does get to the root of everything. Someone looks at you with glazed eyes. I love you. Fine, but what's it going to do for you? It's a basic practical question, which could save you a lot of trouble. What's it going to do for you? Well, I'll make you feel that you're special. I'll make you feel that you're not alone. I'll make your senses feel gratified. Now, then the other person has to decide, is that what I really want? Do I want company, even though I don't know what I'm doing? And the person who's my company, they don't know what they're doing? Do I want my senses gratified? That's the be-all and end-all. I mean, any animal can get that. Do I want to feel special? What's the point in my feeling special when actually I don't have the slightest understanding of where I came from, who I am, and where I'm going? And then meanwhile, we're supposed to love. I thought about all these things. Early in life. And I decided that unless we confront these issues, we're really hiding from ourselves and we don't really care for others. It's really easy to say, I care for you, I love you. But to actually care and love requires quite a bit of qualification, quite a bit of knowledge, understanding. Otherwise, it's like some little boy, little girl playing doctor. Let me operate on you. It's like Sita Pati's son, he could play doctor. You're sick. Oh, I'll cure you. You just laugh. He's well-meaning, but what does he know? Similarly, people go around saying, I care for you, I love you. They're well-meaning, but what do they know? How can they really change someone's life at the deepest level? That requires a lot of understanding, a lot of training, experience. You have to master yourself first before you can deal with others. So most people don't want to pay that price. And the world offers a cheap reward for their very fledgling, caring and loving abilities. And so people just think, well, that's it. We're loving, we're caring. Okay? They don't understand that they're really at such a beginning level. And unless they become motivated to go deeper in terms of loving and caring, there's not going to be any significant change. And that's another reason why people tire of each other after a short time. They're madly in love for a few years, and then the decline comes. They don't know what to do when the flavor wears off. They don't know what to do. Because they haven't been taught to care at a deeper level. What we want to discuss tonight is that deeper level of caring and loving beyond the physical, beyond the mental. In order to get to the spiritual level, we require precise techniques, precise methods for connecting to someone's spiritual identity in relation to the supreme spiritual identity. Because we just all don't exist alone as spiritual entities. Even if you consider just your material identity as body and mind, you don't exist alone. You're part of something. So when we look at our spiritual identity, we should understand what is the greater spiritual whole that I am part of. This is the greatest. This is the greatest vacuum, the nature of the complete spiritual whole. So I often comment that people talk about being holistic, but they have no idea what the whole is. So it's kind of meaningless to talk like that. If you're going to truly love and care, you have to truly be holistic. You have to have knowledge of the complete source of everything. Knowing that complete source of everything, you'll also understand everything that emanates from that source. So this, in short, is the scope of the knowledge that creates a mystic, even within an urban area. And with this kind of knowledge, you'll be able to spare yourself from endless distraction, spinning your back wheels in the mud. Living in the city creates a kind of false sense of meaning for you, just by the fact that you're executing, you're doing things, you're achieving. But we shouldn't become blinded by that false sense of self-importance just because we're achieving within the city. We should take a deep look at our activities and see that there's a big hole in the heart. There's a big gap. Even though externally we're very busy, internally there's a big hole. That hole cannot be filled materially. Now we can run from that reality by becoming busy, 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 busy. But better we confront the reality and try to deal with it. And once we deal with it ourselves, then we can help others to deal with it. So, I wanted to turn to a particular section of Bhagavad Gita, which talks about developing our internal wealth, our internal resources, our internal identity. To such an extent that we're even oblivious, or we feel no need to pay attention to the typical so-called pleasures of the day. There is an internal wealth that we all have that is so powerful and attractive that upon contacting it, we'll forget even about the ordinary temptations of the day. So, we're going to turn to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5. Actually, we'll start with the Pure Victory Mantras on page 1. We'll turn to page 1. Oh, I'm the one who has a book. Okay. Sorry. I guess I'll have to read it. I'll read the Sanskrit. Napashrishyet priyam prapya naudhijet prapya chapriyam stira buddhir asatmuto brahmavid brahmanistataha. Translation, this is Lord Krishna speaking. A person who neither rejoices upon achieving something pleasant nor laments upon obtaining something unpleasant, who is self-intelligent, who is unbewildered, and who knows the science of God, is already situated in transcendence. Now, what does it mean to be situated in transcendence? It means to be above the level of things that have a beginning and end. In other words, it means to be above the level of matter and its interactions. Contemporary science, of course, knows nothing above the level of matter and its interactions. But Bhagavad Gita, while acknowledging the material level of things is opening up for you a completely different dimension above the effect of time, above the limitations of time, space, and thought. That is being situated in transcendence. Now, just think. I don't rejoice upon achieving something unpleasant. And I don't lament upon obtaining something unpleasant. Now, I can understand that I don't want to lament about achieving something unpleasant. But why shouldn't I rejoice when I get something pleasant? The kind of inner wealth that Lord Krishna is talking about in Bhagavad Gita is such that you don't want to be disturbed by either temporary distress or temporary happiness. It's a little difficult to understand, but try to perceive temporary happiness as a kind of agitation or even disturbance. It kind of just hits you in the face. Ah, I'm happy. You can imagine like someone takes a cream pie and just throws it on your face. So happiness hits you like that. Oh, I'm happy. Something's happened to make me happy. So your head spins in a bit of a tizzy, and then it goes away. That feeling goes away. Similarly, distress comes upon you suddenly. Oh, what a worry. Oh, why did this happen? And then that goes away after a while. So, the Bhagavad Gita is teaching you that both happiness and distress are disturbances, they're agitations coming from the outside. All day long, you've got some people who are intent on making you happy and others intent on making you distressed. And various motives in between. So this causes an agitation for your mind. It's outside of you. It's not your internal core being. It's persons trying to deal with your physical covering and your mental covering. If you're truly situated in your spiritual identity, which is the goal of Bhagavad Gita, then you don't want to be capsized by this constant coming and going of temporary happiness and distress. You don't want to be bothered. Just like you're seated on your porch and some bugs are bothering you. Yeah, you just don't want to be bothered. Certainly happiness and distress is like that. But I just don't want to be bothered by it. It'll always be there in the outside atmosphere, but you don't have to connect with it. That's what Krishna is saying in this verse. A person who neither rejoices upon achieving something pleasant, nor laments upon obtaining something unpleasant. In other words, these things are going on, but don't connect with it. Connect with your inner spiritual strength, your Krishna consciousness. Someone who is self-intelligent. Self-intelligent means that they're situated in spiritual understanding. They're not identifying with the temporary body or mind. They're identifying with their spiritual identity, a spirit soul, part of the Supreme Soul. Who's unbewildered? Now, who do you know who's not bewildered in this world? It'll be a very rare person who's not bewildered. Of course, people like to hide their bewilderment. That's why intoxication plays such a necessary role in ordinary life. No one wants to face the fact that they don't know what they're doing. So intoxication is required to cover over the state of perpetual bewilderment. Someone who knows the science of God. Yes. It's not enough to simply acknowledge the existence of God. You have to know the ins and outs of the whole science of God. That is what Bhagavad Gita is teaching. Simply to say, I believe in God, or I follow God. That's a very tiny understanding. We need knowledge of God in order to deepen our relationship with God. So this is what Krishna is aiming to do for us in Bhagavad Gita. So let's hear the purport. The symptoms of the self-realized person are given herein. The first symptom is that he's not illusioned by the false identification of the body with his true self. He knows perfectly well that he is not this body, but is the fragmental portion of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is therefore not joyful in achieving something, nor does he lament in losing anything which is related to his body. This steadiness of mind is called sthira buddhi, or self-intelligence. He is therefore never bewildered by mistaking the gross body for the soul, nor does he accept the body as permanent and disregard the existence of the soul. This knowledge elevates him to the station of knowing the complete science of the absolute truth, namely, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. He thus knows his constitutional position perfectly well, without falsely trying to become one with the Supreme in all respects. This is called Brahman realization, or self-realization. Such steady consciousness is called Krishna consciousness. This purport is telling us about the three levels of observing the Supreme Absolute Truth, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. When you focus upon the Supreme Absolute Truth from quite far away, you just see all-pervading oneness. A common example given is like when you're driving on a road and there's a mountain in the far distance. You just see a dark mass up ahead. You don't see any distinct variegatedness about the mountain. You just see it far ahead as this dark mass. As you get closer, you actually see the form of the mountain, the shape of the mountain. And finally, when you get very close, you can see that on the mountain there are houses, there are cars driving. So similarly, the absolute truth, the supreme absolute truth, when seen from far away, gives you the impression that all there is all-pervading oneness, the Brahman effulgence, the white light. No individuality, no variety, just the one spiritual energy. But when you go further, you see that there is the Supreme Absolute Truth in everyone's heart as the Super Soul, Paramatma. The one Supreme Absolute Truth is there in everyone's heart. And as you get closest, then you can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead, upon whom the impersonal oneness is based. So Bhagavad Gita is telling you that at the root of everything you'll find person. At the root of impersonalism is always a person. So that is a capsule description of the science of God. Of course, it would take volumes to describe all of the science of God. But our human form of life is meant for understanding that science. So do we have any questions thus far? We'll go into maybe one or two more verses. Because I'd like to equip you all with the desire to be a mystic within the city. To be a mystic within the city doesn't mean you're living in your flat and you're staying up all late at night trying to bend a spoon with your mind. To be a mystic within the city doesn't mean that you're playing with tarot cards or Ouija board or something. To be a mystic within the city means that you amidst all the distraction of urban life, can focus on your internal development, your spiritual development. And bring your spiritual practices to a level in which you are qualified to help others, to care for others, to love others. That is the urban mystic. Rather than running away to some lonely place, the outback, you're living in the midst of it all in the city, but with the most noble purposes. You make sure that you have a simple life. You make sure that you're not on overload all the time, information overload, television, internet, telephone, this, that, the other. You work because you have to maintain yourself, but you have no doubts about what the relationship of work is to your life. You understand it's something you have to do if you're going to live in a home, live in a flat. So you go about all your duties and obligations in a way that does not jeopardize your internal spiritual development. That is the urban mystic. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is demonstrating how Arjuna can be a mystic even on the battlefield. So if you can do that on the battlefield, you can certainly do that in the city. The battlefield is the most active, intense place you can imagine, the most pragmatic situation you can imagine. But there, Krishna is teaching Arjuna, a warrior, how to be a mystic, even on the battlefield. So similarly, you can learn from Bhagavad Gita how to be a mystic even in the city. And that will be your greatest achievement. And then you can show others the real love and the real care that you want, but you're not able to. I notice that people get a bit frustrated in that they really want to love, they really want to care, but they realize, I don't know how. After a while, they realize, I don't know how. And after the passion dies down, it becomes routine, then they realize, how do I really show lasting care, true affection? You know, we've already exhausted each other physically, so is there anything else that we can do? People actually get frustrated about that. I don't know. So, someone who's a genuine urban mystic, they know how to deal with themselves and deal with others. They understand that you must have a deep connection in order to be genuine, to be for real. You have to have a deep connection. A deep connection that goes beyond the mental plane, the physical plane. You've got to be able to connect with the spiritual plane. And that means you need knowledge. There's no point in just using the word spiritual without knowledge. And this is what everyone is missing today. If you're truly committed to spiritual development, you need comprehensive knowledge of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So, if we can move on, unless you have some questions. We'll go on to text 21. This text is going to be a little provocative. Don't mind. Provocative things make you think. Bahya sparshesh prasaktatma vindad yatmani yat sukham. Sabrahma yoga yuktatma sukham akshayam asyute. Lord Krishna speaking. Such a liberated person is not attracted to material sense pleasure, but is always entranced, enjoying the pleasure within. In this way, the self-realized person enjoys unlimited happiness, for he concentrates on the Supreme. Now let's look at the various elements of this verse. Such a liberated person. What does it mean to be a liberated person? What do you think, to be a liberated person?
Maybe free.
Free from? Then you're liberated. If it means to be liberated,
free from physical desires. Mm-hmm.
Do you think those might be the only desires, or physical? John, what would you say to be liberated?
Internal serenity.
Internal serenity, which comes from?
When free from diversity of bondages.
Often, the word is used in terms of women, and now it's even being used in terms of men. What does it mean to be a liberated woman? that's a good answer. What does it mean to be a liberated man? It
means you never feel okay wearing a pink shirt.
Liberated, as used by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, means free from any material influence. Because as long as there's material influence in your life, you'll be bound. You'll be shackled. Such a liberated person is not attracted to material sense pleasure. How could you not be attracted to material sense pleasure? I mean, isn't it here for a reason? People often argue. It's here, material sense pleasure, so why not indulge in? I mean, it's here. There's a lot of things here that you don't indulge in. Poison is here. What's here? Poison. Why don't you drink it? But then people will say, but material sense pleasure is not poison. You know, it's just part of life. It's something to do. It's boring, but still it's something to do. The only way that the liberated person is not attracted to material sense enjoyment is because he or she has much more pleasurable things to do. The pleasure that you perceive on the material platform is just a shadow of the pleasure that exists on the spiritual platform, the pleasure of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, why? If you know about the real thing, the substance, would you pursue the shadow? That is the real question. So the liberated person is not attracted to material sense pleasure, but is always entranced. What does it mean to always be entranced? It means to be always absorbed in the spiritual reality. To such an intensity that nothing external compromises you. You're fixed in your core spiritual identity. So much so that it can be, so much so that that concentration you have could be said to be a trance. You're enjoying the pleasure within. The pleasure within means the pleasure of the spirit soul in relation to the supreme soul. In this way, the self-realized person enjoys unlimited happiness, for he concentrates on the supreme. See, that is what the mystic is interested in. Unlimited happiness for me, and then to share it with others. And gradually, the urban mystic finds out that the more I consider others' spiritual happiness, the more automatically I'll be spiritually happy. Now, when we look at the purport, we see a provocative example. But it makes us think. Sri Yamunacharya, a great devotee in Krishna consciousness, said, Yat avvaji mama chitta Krishna padaravinde nava nava rasa dhaman yudhyatam vantumasi tat avvaji bhatanari sangame smaryamane bhavati mukha vikara shushtu nishtivanam cha. Do you ever memorize this verse many years ago?
Yes. I did.
All right. Translation is provocative, but please try to understand how it could be so. Since I have been engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna, realizing ever new pleasure in him, whenever I think of sex pleasure, I spit at the thought, and my lips curl with distaste. What is the explanation of that? A person in Brahma Yoga, or Krishna consciousness, is so absorbed in the loving service of the Lord that he loses his taste for material sense pleasure altogether. Can you imagine that? Losing your taste for material sense pleasure altogether. Where did it go? Where did that taste go? Who wants it anyway? It's just useless. I got better things to do. Just like as little kids, you did so many things that you later lost your taste for. Maybe some of you remember. Maybe you were a stamp collector when you were a kid. Anyway, you were a stamp collector. Anyone else? Anyone? Yes? You collected stamps. What age did you drop it?
Okay.
Yeah. What age did you drop it? You were a stamp collector, coin collector,
comics.
You collected comic books. I collected sports cards. Cards of famous athletes. So, Samarat Udha, you don't do that now. You outgrew it. You lost the taste. So a person in Krishna consciousness is so absorbed in the loving service of the Lord that he loses his taste for material sense pleasure altogether. That is the natural progression of Krishna consciousness or bhakti yoga. You just lose your taste. It falls away from you because you have better things to do. It's not that the urban mystic, the Krishna conscious person, is just locking himself, herself up in a flat on a Friday night, and Saturday night, when everyone else is out carousing and you're biting your fingernails. No. You have better things to do. Therefore, you've lost the taste for these low activities. Now, here it is admitted, quite frankly, that the highest pleasure in terms of matter is sex pleasure. The whole world is moving under its spell, and a materialist cannot work at all without this motivation. But a person engaged in Krishna consciousness can work with greater vigor without sex pleasure, which he avoids. That is the test in spiritual realization. Spiritual realization and sex pleasure go ill together. A Krishna conscious person is not attracted to any kind of sense pleasure due to his being a liberated soul. In other words, due to his or her not being under the influence of material nature. As soon as you're under the influence of material nature, you're filled with all these temporary desires just by your association with material nature. So if you can pull the trick off of detaching yourself from material nature, then your pathway to liberation is quite clear. So a lot of this requires thought, I know. A lot of what we're discussing, a lot of what we're reading. But certainly it is more than worth it if you will apply your consciousness to understanding this information. And the great possibility is there that you will not only consolidate your own spiritual identity, but you'll be able to help others. You'll be qualified to help others. In this way, the ranks of the urban mystics increases. How someone can live in the city and be free from all material influence is possible. The easiest way it's done is when you're maximizing your connection to Krishna and you're minimizing your connection to the mundane material things of this world. Well, maybe we'll stop there and see if you have any questions about anything.
No question.
You know all this.
But I still have a question.
All right.
Sometimes people are in a group of thinking about things that ask them due to some hesitation and shame that they don't ask. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes I like to ask a question even though I know the answer.
All right. You'll allow him to do that?
Well,
it's all right.
I'm going to do it anyway.
Okay.
Sometimes we've seen that people will read these passages that you've read about taking the spiritual life and then losing desire for mundane things or sense pleasure and such. And indeed, at times they become discouraged because they feel as though I take to this spiritual life and then I'll give up wanting to drive fast cars and chase women and so on and so forth. So, how then do you keep these people interested or get them to understand that although they may be giving up these mundane things, still that the greatest treasure is spiritual knowledge?
Anyone here interested in driving fast cars and constantly chasing women?
These are simple analogies.
I do that. Huh?
No, I'm mistaken.
Drive fast cars?
That's a good dream.
You die?
Or it could be acquiring vast amounts of wealth.
Mm-hmm. You, John, you were into driving fast cars and chasing beautiful women.
I used to
Why did you stop?
It was very expensive.
I thought that these days the expenses for going out are shared by both. There's no gender. Oh, that's just the theory, doesn't it? And the man still has to fork it over, huh?
Yeah, I guess. That's the reference.
Of course, you're older, so you're definitely coming from the time when the man had to foot the bill, right? So you found it very expensive also?
To be quite honest, I found it very empty.
Mm.
I lived that life for many years, and I remember standing there one night thinking, I've done all the things that are supposed to make a male happy, and I feel as empty as a...
Good point. So then it's not a bit provocative for you to hear this kind of thing. You could ask. And for you, was it?
It makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's threatening if you don't have any understanding of just something better. Some people do feel threatening.
What do you mean? No sense pleasure.
And they feel so threatened they can't even hear clearly what's being said again and again, that because you're concentrating on the supreme, you let go. You lose your taste for material sense pleasure altogether. It's like a child loses his taste for stamp collecting or coin collecting. So, in answer to your question, yes, there are some persons who are so attached to these lower pursuits They're so absorbed in it, they actually can't hear anything else. It's difficult to deal with such cases. But the fact is, by constantly hearing the transcendental reality of Bhagavad Gita, there'll be a change. They just hear it again and again. If they have that good fortune, they'll hear it again and again and again. Repeated hearing. Maybe it'll take several births before something clicks. You see, people are at different levels due to their spiritual evolution. Some have already done so many lower pursuits in their previous life, and so in this life they're just not interested at all. Just like both John and Don said, yeah, been there, done that. In this life, they did it. Well, some people have been there and done that in their previous life. It's like you could have been like that. You started your career in transcendence when you were 14. So, we have to be prepared for people to be a bit defensive. You shouldn't be surprised. Because all they know is what the TV and Hollywood is telling you.
Just wanted to have a question. What's in regard to sex life? Is there not a balance to be found by having been brought up from a Christian perspective? And in the Bible, you know, the Song of Songs, really talks about the joy of husband and wife making love, obviously in the context of marriage. is there not a balance to be found? Is there not a healthy balance there somewhere?
That's interesting. I was just in Israel. Many of the Jews believe that Song of Solomon is not so much about a man and woman, it's about the soul's rapture with God. But anyway, if you want to take it in that way, as you're describing, you can look at it, and you see, believe it or not, there might be something better to do with a woman than those things. It could be possible. But this knowledge is not well known. It's possible to connect on the spiritual level and to be partners in enlightenment. And that is much more fulfilling than the passion sessions. Now, there's another point that in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he is the sex life according to Dharma or according to spiritual principles. In other words, if the husband and wife purposely engage in relations in order to bring into the world an advanced soul, Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita, I am that activity. Otherwise, so many creatures are being procreated, taking birth. Rabbits have children, pigs have children. What is so special about human beings giving birth to children, unless the children are special? And in order for the children to be truly special, they require special parents who, during the time of conception, have their consciousness so fixed on the Supreme, on Krishna, that they're able to attract to the womb of the mother a highly evolved soul. So if you can do that, then yes, go on. Multiply. Multiply and be fruitful. But the problem is that most persons have no idea of this, how the consciousness of the mother and father at the time of conception attracts a certain quality entity to the womb. No idea about that. So, because so many people's consciousness is deranged when they're conceiving, you have very bewildered, deranged children taking birth. The actual problem with the world is not the quantity of the population, it's the quality. Humans today do not know how to produce a quality population. And unqualified population is the direct result of procreative activity without higher consciousness. How does that sound to you? You agree?
Yeah.
Okay. In other words, the mother and father have a huge responsibility to bring into the world a highly qualified child. That responsibility is far beyond any temporary sensory pursuits. In other words, we're talking once again about how to be an urban mystic. How even within your family life in the city, you can do amazing things. Even procreation can be an amazing thing when properly executed for transcendental purposes. So there's no need for passion to be the hallmark of a marriage. The husband and wife can be partners in enlightenment, and they can together sample a much higher dimension than what the ordinary couple would experience.
I was going to say, perhaps.
What would never be necessary?
For a husband and wife, that perhaps it feels not necessary to be a child.
Well, then how are advanced saintly persons going to appear? Unless. Therefore, there's a need for saintly mothers, saintly fathers, transcendental mothers, transcendental fathers, to put their. For them to populate the world with actually high class, highly qualified children. Not everybody has to do that, though. But for those who are attracted, generally in this world, man wants to be with woman, woman wants to be with man. So, Bhagavad Gita is presenting a methodology by which man can be with woman, woman can be with man, but they're not just stuck in a rut of mutual physical stimulation as the be-all and end-all. No, they understand that they can actually make a difference in the world by procreating in the proper consciousness, so much so that great entities will take birth in their family and will cause great change in the future in the world. Wouldn't that be much more satisfying to a mother?
Oh, definitely.
And no doubt, probably in the future, you would have a family, right? Yeah, so wouldn't you feel good to know that you gave birth to a son or daughter who was so powerful spiritually they could actually bring about changes in the world? Wouldn't you be?
If ever it was going to happen, absolutely.
Yeah.
You want
to feel pretty sure. What about
you, Dad? It's quite scary, Patsy, if you're playing the child. Thanks for very well.
Yeah.
It can also go right.
Not everyone in the world has to take up this aspect of yoga. I myself chose not to. Actually, you know, there's a way you can make everyone your family member. Well, I just have a limited family. What about the whole world? So, since time immemorial, even in different religious traditions, there's always those who just say, I won't engage in the typical limited family life so that I can consider the whole world my family. But certainly if you're going to be an urban mystic, you've got to get on top of this sensuality. Cities these days mean sensuality. It's like last week I was in, maybe 10 days ago, I was in Las Vegas, known as Sin City. Big tourist place. 85%, the statistics say that 85% of the tourists who come to Las Vegas, and many families of kids, the husband and wife have no intention of gambling. But because it's just everywhere, they got to get into it a bit. Cities generally mean that. Clubs, restaurants, cafes. To stimulate your senses. But there is a way you can live in the city and be immune to all the passionate exchanges taking place. So certainly the urban mystic has to know how to deal with starting a family in high consciousness. But not everyone needs to do that. There should always be a section of the population that's free from those activities. Because the truth is, you come into this world with nothing, you leave with nothing. If you can understand that you can make the greatest impact purely on the spiritual platform, then you can do the greatest good for the world. But that takes a qualification, as you were saying. So who wants to spend the time to develop qualification? Very few persons. Anything else?
I do have a question. So these habits, and I found this book very useful, very practical, because it helps me break bad habits.
Which book?
The Tao.
You read the whole thing?
Yes.
Yeah, very good.
Because simply by concentrating on the Supreme.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have practical problems. There are different qualities. In Chapter 8, there's some of the main qualities of the Supreme to concentrate on. I'm wondering how you can concentrate on all the qualities that you need to concentrate on all of them at the same time. And also, what about what's driving here today?
Mm-hmm.
How do I concentrate
very
in
good.
The middle of traffic or at work?
Mm-hmm. Very good. Question. You concentrate on all the qualities of Krishna at once by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. That gives you everything else. That sound vibration is packed with all the aspects and qualities of Krishna in one bundle. It's the master switch that turns on all the lights in the house. You know, in modern houses or flats, they have one switch by the front door that clicks off all the lights in the house. Our cars have a master lock, so you don't have to lock each door individually. So this is the master lock, the Hare Krishna mantra. You get everything through that.
So I can simply chant it? Do I have to concentrate on the sound? Or do I just chant it?
Chant, yes. Best is concentration, but you can also chant with just spontaneously. the best day, the most powerful urban mystics, they get up early in the morning before the other people get up and kind of spread their materialistic vibrations. You notice the morning is very peaceful. 4 to 6 a.m. You get up and you chant the Hare Krishna mantra with concentration. And there's nothing more than that that will produce such a dramatic transformation over a period of a couple of weeks if you do it seriously. And then while you're driving, while you're on the bus, you can chant the Hare Krishna mantra also. The main thing, though, if you're a serious urban mystic, the main thing is that you take advantage of those early morning hours when everything is calm and really connect with yourself at the deepest level. Always in trance, enjoying the pleasure within. So that you want to try. That's the next step after reading Bhagavad Gita. The mantra meditation. You've been doing that for how many weeks now?
Six.
This is Oliver from where? He just finished college. He's contemplating his transcendental career. He was doing quite well in school up until the last couple of years when he got into activities which are quite common, quite normal these days. But not so good for your concentration. So after finishing school, he developed an interest, a deep interest in Krishna consciousness. So now he's in the position to make his life quite extraordinary over a period of time. He's in that position. He's got it in his grasp. So what he does, of course, that's up to him. He's got the chance. He's got the ticket in his hand.
So, are you saying then that to be an urban mystic, the major component is that we have a degree of spirituality about us, even though we're in this world working, going to school, raising families, so on and so forth?
That's not a degree of spirituality, but you should have a like a blazing furnace of spirituality in the core of your heart.
Blazing furnace in the core of the heart.
Yes. Yes. That's what it takes to keep your head above the water. Energy of illusion is very powerful. You've got to feel it just like you feel Brisbane on a summer day when the temperature's in the 40s. You know what that feels like, right? There's just no way you can avoid the reality of Brisbane on a hot midsummer day. You feel it. Similarly, you've got to feel in the core of your heart the Krishna conscious experience. And that will insulate you from any inferior or lower activities. There's just so much relishing the superior. You don't have time to fit the inferior thing in your life, nor do you have any real desire. Sometimes memories can come back, but they don't capsize you. It's all about getting something better, and then we don't mind giving up the lower thing. All right, shall we do some more chanting? We have one. How do we go about getting
something better? That will develop in the qualifications belong to, then you know that.
The whole process of Krishna consciousness is meant to connect you to Krishna. Krishna is the source of the supreme love. Once you're connected to Krishna, then you can easily see your connection to all living entities. We're all part of Krishna, and you know how to act for the benefit of all the other living entities because you know your connection to Krishna, who's the source of everything. It's like watering the tree at the root, and all the branches blossom. But you try to water each blossom individually, it's not very practical. It won't work. Glad that you're reading. Okay, we have Omer Dungi here.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
All right.
We have a little.
Yeah.
A little refreshment. Anything you'd like to discuss? Anything you want? Let me know. Very nice to meet you on flower. Mindy and John. Okay. We hope that your progress in Krishna consciousness is smooth, and certainly it will be quite exciting.
Exciting.
Let's be back again in December.
December, Krishna willing, December 8th through 16th. December 8th through 16th, Krishna willing. Unless I'm caught in some bombing in the London metro system, or some suicide bombing in Israel or something like that. I'll be anything can happen in the world these days, you know.
If in your travels, mm-hmm. you see someone that you know, tell them that's it.
Okay. New Zealand. I'm always moving. I'll only be there until the 21st of August. Then I won't be back until December 16th. But the best time to come, either the last week in December or the last days in January, beginning of February. Then we're having a big gathering. The end of December is near Wellington. The end of January is in between Wellington and Auckland. Be the guest of honor.
Huh?
Be the guest of honor.
Well, one reason why I'm talking to Philly is one of my students is going to New Zealand.
Where?
And Christchurch. Starting up a school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about his mom as well. I'm being the guest of honor there.
Yeah, and you've stay in contact with me and come over at the time when we have, because I'm on the move all the time.
But you have email, yes?
Yes.
Okay. I've been reading this a book of yours. It's a Vedic book.
Gives you a bit of a workout, huh? Gives you a bit of a workout, huh?
Indeed. Quite like the matter of that. I brought it with me. I'm not going to order that.
All right.
I write something very nice.
Two festivals is recommended for us to come to?
The one at the end of January.
I think that's what we can go to the December one.
Huh?
That means we can go to the December festival here at November.
Mm.
And we go to the January and December.
Mm.
does. Yes. I intend to show off. People pick this book up and I read this nice description that you wrote. So, oh, you know this man? That's all. And your email as well.
Probably the last time you get to come to the dog.
Fair enough.
I'm moving out.
Wait,
you've got
many
things. The new place is a bit closer to the loft. It's in Reed Hill. You know the son called Shane? Melvin? Son called Shane is in Milton. So towards the river, you go to Coronation Drive. It's coming back up away from the river. You go up through Milton, son called Shane, and then Red Hill is up.
Yeah,
Milton.
Allison, can you give us stuff? I'll be last week. Yeah. Because it didn't leave any archaeological traces that have been found yet. And
didn't leave any?
That are found yet.
Why not?
There could be many reasons. natural, geological, so-called disasters, or not looking in the right places, or so many things. The only remains are the literature. But the emphasis on ancient history these days is, has to be something in the dirt. Get your hands up. People like that kind of proof, as opposed to other kinds.
Is it similar to Troy? They look at the Alpine.
Right, right. They all thought it was mythology.
Right, the Bible.
Yeah.
The career.
Yeah. They really thought it was, for sure it was mythology. So, yes. What you're going to ask about is that picture of me and Easter Island for real.
Well, is it?
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Sure it was. When you were there, did you feel or sense anything?
No.
No?
Just relief from jet lag. By sound. That's my opinion.
By sound? Mm-hmm. Now, I read something when you said that recording somebody. And by sound, the blast curves and all the hundreds of feet in the air. How about that by sound?
Mantra. That subtle technology is lost today. Although I discuss how there are reports that it was being done in Tibet even up until the early part of the 20th century. So, Don, you have a demanding high tech job?
It's not too bad. He's got lots of good people, so I hope that might be quite certain that he can have a deep job.
Recommend someone develop the rural environment into the urban mystic environment?
Well, where would you go?
Huh?
If you have good association?
That's fine. Do you think that would help?
Well, you probably have more to do, and growing young man needs lots to do. At the same time, I think there's no harm in you building your foundation now. Maybe by the next time I come, December, I think. See how you're doing. But if you really take advantage of the next 6 months, 5 or 6 months to build your foundation. I think that would be the best thing.
Yeah.
It's working out for now, okay, for you, yes?
Yeah.
Main thing is to get that solid foundation here in the channel.
Yep.
The only thing that might be better than that for now is if, you know, you could talk to Sita Pappu and see if they have some facility for you to gradually build your foundation. But you need to start at the shallow end of the pool, not jump into the deep end. Start the shallow end and proceed to the middle of the pool and to the deep end.
Recent
times? I haven't seen him in 5 years. Right, I guess I'll be on my way.
What time will you be leaving for the airport
tomorrow? It's supposed to be, I don't know, we have to find out. To be at the airport at 8 o'clock, what time do I have to leave?
This is in the morning, it'll probably take about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So, 7:20 to get there by 8.
So, you've discussed that, you've researched that?
That's.
Your
experience.
All right.
In the morning, it's a peak time, so we'll be better not to.
Even between 7 and 8?
Yeah, that's where the peak time starts.
So 7 o'clock?
I mean, more traffic from coming to the city when you're going, because we're going to pass through the city.
Yeah, I remember this is one spot where it.
We can get stuck. You know,
yeah, I remember there's one spot.
Maybe we can leave at 7:30, but that's.
No.
You better believe it's 7:20.
Okay.
If you go down Coronation Drive and take the 2-3 then, you can just cruise right down.
Yeah. So,
everything was good?
It's great.
Okay.
Oh, it's not ice cream. But we've done this in the streets, yes.
Demonstration and give a reading from the Mahabharata. I should be there.
No, where will I be, Balaams? When is that?
19.
Yeah, I'll be in Auckland.
Auckland.
Maybe on the 21st for Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'm trying to get over to Auckland. see my family and look at the new life. So it's exciting to go to the pioneering zones.
It's a love.
Nice to see you as always.
Trying to save
you. Yes. Same as can be in this dangerous world.
I will come and see you in New Zealand.
Okay, just agree.
I'll bring you the entourage as well.
Okay. And give a demonstration.
If you like. I'll bring some of the coming chuckies with me.
All right.
You drive safely. If you don't drive safely, something happens to this man, I will not look upon you favorably.
I think it's happening somewhere. Okay. Mm-hmm. Diamond, diamond. Mm-hmm.